From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish, and this is Game of Thrones.
Kill him! Kill all of them, I command it!
You kill me, your brother's a dead man.
You're right. Take him alive. Kill his men.
The popular HBO series, adapted from the books of George R.R. Martin, is one blood-soaked power play after another. But in a world where brute strength is often the difference between life and a slow death, the show's strongest character stands less than 5 feet tall. His name is Tyrion Lannister.
Let me give you some advice, bastard. Never forget what you are. The rest of the world will not. Wear it like armor, and it can never be used to hurt you.
What the hell do you know about being a bastard?
All dwarves are bastards in their father's eyes.
That's actor Peter Dinklage. He got his big break in 2003 in the critically acclaimed film The Station Agent. He followed that with memorable roles in Elf and on 30 Rock. Though Dinklage has never had a showcase like Game of Thrones, he admits he was leery at first of playing Tyrion Lannister.
When I first read the role, I told my grandmother about it, and she's no longer with us, sadly, but she was an amazing woman. But she misunderstood me, and she thought I said interior banisters. And she was quite confused by that. So it got off to like sort of a clunky start. I hadn't read the books, so I wasn't too familiar with it. But I knew David Benioff and Dan Weiss, and they sort of set me straight about this character. Because I had some severe reservations about going into the realm of fantasy.
Why?
I don't know. My own silly prejudice, I guess, against the genre in terms of someone my height. Usually it's a bit, how do I say this politely without offending anybody else's work in amazing things? It's bearded and pointy-chewed. And this character, Tyrion Lannister, isn't that way at all.
And we should mention your height is under 5 feet, correct?
Yes, four and a half feet. I am a dwarf. And what immediately attracted to me to this, any actor will tell you the same thing, no matter what part it is. It just has to be very well-rounded, and this character is.
He seems to walk the line between self-preservation and empathy in a world that, of course, is just incredibly brutal and violent. And there's one scene I'm thinking of in particular, I think it's in the first season, where your character offers the gift of a horse saddle to a young boy who's lost the use of his legs, and we have that clip.
Will I really be able to ride?
You will. On horseback, you'll be as tall as any of them.
Is this some kind of trick? Why do you want to help him?
I have a tender spot in my heart for cripples, bastards, and broken things.
You've done my brother a kindness. The hospitality of Winterfell is yours.
Spare me your false courtesies, Lord Stark. There's a brothel outside your walls. There I'll find a bed, and both of us can sleep easier.
Yeah, he does have a soft spot in his heart.
And a lot of humor. I feel like he's, in a way, the most modern character in his sarcasm and in some of his
lines. Yeah, I mean,
that's
just, as you said, it's his sort of survival mechanism at work. He knows he has no skills with the sword, so he sort of beats people to the punchline.
But he's not the joke, which I think is one of the things that makes
it
someone you can
jokes.
Root for.
He's,
right. I mean, and I wondered about that because obviously the physicality is such a major part of the role. I mean, he's nicknamed the Imp, and you talked about your reservations there of kind of playing a character that could be subject to.
Well, I don't have a problem playing those characters as long as it's told intelligently. It would be stupid if he wasn't addressed as an imp or something in this world, given the surroundings. It does address the size issue, but it doesn't knock you over the head with it because you don't really need to. And I find all the scripts that I get that I'm not very interested in, it's a constant reminder. Every single page, almost every single line is geared towards your height. And I just, in my day-to-day life, in any person who is my size's day-to-day life, it happens, but it's not a constant.
at the same time, your career, when I look at some of the roles you've had in the past, the breakout role people describe as being in the movie The Station Agent a while back, even a big budget film like Elf, where you played a very sort of pugnacious children's publisher, if that is an accurate description.
Yes.
It seems like you've managed to find the roles that upend whatever those stereotypes might be.
Yeah. Well, I try to, you know, and that's, I'm not always successful at it. You do have to make a living, and I do not fault anyone else who makes choices to play characters that they wish they hadn't agreed to do. And because at the end of the day, none of us are happy with our jobs all the time. But I just sort of I had some perseverance in terms of what I wanted to do and what I didn't want to do. And I think no is a very powerful word in our business that is very hard to use early on in your career. But I also think I was pretty arrogant when I was younger. So I use that word maybe too much, but it also helped me with finding roles that I did like.
What was the first time you stood on stage and thought, I want to act and this is the only thing I want to do?
Oh, it was so many years ago, I don't remember.
Oh, you're a baby. Give me a break.
I think a lot of us are just little hams when we're children, and it just starts that way. My mom's a music school teacher, and kids would come in. It was a revolving door policy at our house growing up in New Jersey, where piano lessons were given all day throughout the day, and my brother and I would be putting on puppet shows down in the basement and constructing these elaborate sets and putting on these shows for all the octogenarians of the neighborhood that were kind enough to pay a nickel.
So the arts was sort of, this was something in your background.
It just came at an early age, yeah. I don't know when it starts, when you trace it back to when you were a little child. You can't really remember this big moment. I think it's a lot of little moments that build up into something that just forms who you are and your need to be an actor.
I was reading in my research for this interview, there was an article in which you talked about wanting to reach the point in your career where you could be the lead, quote, and get the girl. And looking at Game of Thrones and your character and sort of where you're moving in your career, do you feel like you're reaching that point or reaching the point where you're being offered parts that aren't about your height, that are more about the character?
Yeah, it's always a struggle. It'll always be a struggle, I think, with any actor. The leads are often the boring part, though. Maybe I'll have to take that back. I like playing the guy on the sidelines. They have more fun.
Well, we're having a lot of fun watching you, so good luck with the rest of the season.
Thank you very much.
Actor Peter Dinklage, he currently stars in the HBO series Game of Thrones. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Audie.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're switching gears now. You might know Tia Mowry from her days as a teen actress. She starred alongside her identical twin sister, Tamara, on the television show Sister, Sister. Today, she's all grown up and starring in BET's sexy, provocative series, The Game. This will be her last season on the show, where she played medical student-turned-football wife Melanie Barnett. But behind the scenes, Tia had her own medical drama. She was trying to get pregnant and then conceal her pregnancy with her real-life husband, Corey. How she pulled it off is just one of the tidbits of advice she shares in her new book, Oh Baby, Pregnancy Tales and Advice from One Hot Mama to Another. And Tia Mowry is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
What gave you the idea to write the book?
Well, the main reason is, you know, when I was pregnant, you know, and especially if it's your first baby, you're anxious, you're nervous, you're scared. And the first thing that you do, you just go out there and you just buy all of the pregnant books that are out there on the shelves. And I just found out that all of them were extremely medically driven, and they just focused on all of the scary stuff that goes on through pregnancy. And I was like, I don't really need to be reminded of this. I'm already scared as it is. I need, you know, someone to just talk to me and just, you know, make me feel like, you know, you're just talking to their girlfriend. And it needed to be fun, informative at the same time. And that's why I decided to write this book, because I felt like that's what was missing.
Well, on the cover, you are actually a very hot mama. You are wearing some killer heels, which even now some of us would have trouble staying upright on. But one of the things that I liked about the book is, first of all, you are very candid about the struggle you had just getting pregnant.
Yeah.
I think that's important because I think that particularly for women of color, perhaps there is not a lot of literature that even describes the emotional challenge of dealing with infertility.
Yeah.
I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, I didn't even know what endometriosis was when my doctor diagnosed me with it. I was having a lot of pain whenever I would, you know, have my menstrual. And I even went to several doctors and they were like, oh, these are just cramps. And one day I was just having really, really bad cramps that I was really close to calling an ambulance. And I called, you know, my family doctor at the time and she was like, Tia, just get on the treadmill, take a hot bath, put some heat on it. I'm like, look, I am in pain. So my friend who was staying in the same building, she knew the OBGYN that delivered Will Smith kids, Dr. Dolores Kent. She's amazing. And I saw her and the first time I just sat down with her, she did an ultrasound and she's like, I think you have endometriosis.
Well, you know what I'm interested in is I have to assume you have medical insurance. You certainly have access to health care.
Yeah.
You are a young woman.
Yeah.
And I guess I think that a lot of people might be surprised that there was still so much ignorance around a common medical condition and one that seems to particularly affect women of color. We're not really quite sure why. What do you make of that?
You know what? I don't know. Like I said, I had no idea what this was. And here I am, a woman of color. And my first doctor, who was just my family doctor, never said anything about it. I had more than one ultrasound. More than one. And she never mentioned it to me whatsoever. And I think also, when you're young, you're like, this is just cramps. So, yeah.
The other thing that you are very candid about in the book was your concern for your career.
Yeah.
Once you became pregnant. And again, I'm really interested in this because this is an experience that I think other people will have, although it's kind of unique in your case in the sense that, as you point out in the book, you spend a lot of time in lingerie. You know, it's a little different from most workplaces, at least that I've been familiar with.
Yeah.
But it is a challenge that I think a lot of people aren't particularly honest about. And could you just talk a little bit about that? I mean, is it the idea that, you know, if you're not sexy, then you're not employable?
Well, unfortunately, I will say this. There was this one director that I was working with, and they were auditioning some girls, and I knew who the girl that they were seeing, and I thought she was great, and I was like, why did she not get that role? He specifically told me she did not get this role because she just had a baby.
Now we've heard this some from other artists, like, for example, Toni Braxton has previously spoken about how the record label that she was with at one time was not aggressive in pushing one of her albums after she had her child.
Yeah.
What is that? Do you think, is this a woman problem? Is this a...
I will be really honest with you.
What is this?
I think for me, you know, because I was a little, I was scared and afraid. But ever since I had Cree, it seems like my career has opened up even more. I wanted to write a book and they were able to, you know, work everything out so I could write a book. And then right after that, I was able to, you know, do a movie. I just finished doing a movie with Tori Spelling, who just had a baby as well. I think it's harder for women who are viewed as vixens in this business. So if they are seen as these, you know, sexy kittens, you know, and it's harder for men to view them as sexy again, you know, because they just had their baby, which I think is not cool. I feel more sexy. I feel, you know, empowered because I gave life. I have a son now. I feel like I'm stronger.
I am woman, hear me roar.
Yeah, I am woman, hear me. And that's what I wrote in my book.
You try this, director.
Yeah.
Not giving people a job. You try this.
But with me, I've always had this, you know, girl next door. You know, I have a very clean image. So I think it's an easier transition.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm joined by Tia Mori. Her new book tells about the joys and the pains of pregnancy. The title is Oh Baby, Pregnancy Tales and Advice from One Hot Mama to Another. So let's get to some of the fun parts. What was the best thing about being pregnant? What was the worst?
I think the best thing about being pregnant would definitely have to be seeing just my belly grow and seeing, like, wow, there is... you know, something inside of me, really, no matter what I do, it's going to be working. Like, just, you know, it's unbelievable how the human body is. The worst part about pregnancy would definitely have to be my nausea. I don't know why it's just called morning sickness, because morning sickness never just happened in the morning for me, and it's not happening just in the morning for my sister. She's pregnant 4 months right now. Mine happened in the morning, afternoon, and in the evening, and not only did it just happen in the first trimester, it happened throughout my whole entire pregnancy. I'm like, dang, how come nobody told me about this?
Well, that's why you have this book now.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about your career now. What, mm-hmm. You have a lot of fans on the game. What is it about that series that you think connected with people?
One thing that I love about the show, number one, is it focuses on women and, you know, women who are powerful, women who are successful. But also, these women were real and relatable. And one thing in particular that I loved about my character was it showed her flaws. Not everybody is perfect. Everybody goes through certain journeys, you know, within their lives. And they showed that. This show also talks about things that a lot of people don't talk about. We talked about infidelity and, you know, baby mama drama. You know, we talked about realistic stories, I think, that women go through and that we overcome.
And now you're working on a reality show with your sister, yes. Your twin, Tamara.
Yes.
I understand that that's actually going very well, too.
Yeah.
It's a top-ranked show on Style Network. Yeah. What do you think people are interested in with that?
For some reason, I think people resonate with my sister and I because we're real people. We're honest. And then also they feel like they grew up with us and we're hilarious.
What's your best bit of advice for somebody who's maybe just starting on this journey?
The one advice that I would give just to moms who have a child or a newborn is definitely sleep while the baby sleeps. I've heard that so many times. I never realized how true it really is. If you don't, you'll be walking around like a zombie. The other thing is, as a new mom, trust your instincts. It's embedded in you. We were created, I think personally, for this. We were born to just know really what to do. For women who are pregnant, sometimes when you're pregnant, everybody, especially your mother-in-law, your whatever, sister-in-law who's already had kids, they kind of want to throw all of their ways on how they had a child, whether that's make sure you breastfeed or make sure you don't get an epidural. You know, it's up to you. This is your baby. You have the right to do whatever you want. And if you have a mother-in-law that's constantly pointing her finger, don't argue with her. Just smile and nod and just say, okay, thank you, because you don't want to get into an argument. You're pregnant. You don't need to be stressed.
Bring out your inner Tia.
Right? Yeah.
Tia Mori is an actress. She joins her identical twin on the Style Network's Tia and Tamara. She was kind enough to join me in our Washington, D.C. studio to talk about her book, Oh Baby, Pregnancy Tales and Advice from One Hot Mama to Another. Tia, thank you so much for joining
thank you.
Us.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. Let us now praise a TV program from the early 1960s. Route 66 went on the air more than 50 years ago on CBS, and it did something few dramatic shows have ever done. It filmed entirely on the road, crisscrossing the United States. Each week, a new location, new characters, new situations. Well, this week, the complete series has been released in a DVD box set. I've watched a lot of these old shows, and there were a few key ingredients that held Route 66 together. First, a great theme by Nelson Riddle. Second, great scripts by Sterling Siliphant. Third, a cool car, a Corvette. And finally, actors Martin Milner and, in this clip, George Maharis.
Me and my buddy, we're conducting a private treasure hunt. We keep moving, place to place, town to town, Wyoming, Montana, Pennsylvania, Texas, the whole checkerboard. You see, we're looking, trying to find us that star. But when we do, we're going to grab a piece of it and stick it in the ground. Then we put up a sign, home.
George Maharis, who played Buzz Murdoch, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You actually went all over the country, and it was shot on location.
That's right.
Very ambitious cinematography. I mean, the
very.
It's unlike nearly all other television that I can recall. But how quickly were these being produced?
Well, they originally slated them for 7 days, but none of them got done in 7 days. It usually took between 9 and 10 days a lot of the time, and of course that put us behind schedule, so we worked 7 days a week to stay ahead.
Now, I want you to describe you and Martin Milner, your co-star, his character's Corvette. And I want you to describe the premise, which requires a slight suspension of disbelief here, that the two of you are riding around all of the United States, one short-term part-time job to another part-time job.
I was working for Marty's dad, and Marty's dad died and left him nothing except the Corvette. And I have a conversation with Marty saying, let's get in the Corvette and see where we belong. So basically what we were doing was searching for the right place to stop and spend the rest of your life. Because beginning, when we first started the series, it was not called Route 66, it was called The Searchers. Mm. And of course, that name was already given to somebody else, so they changed it to Route 66.
Now, we should say here that even in the first episode, given the title Route 66, one thing was clear.
How do we get off US 66, Buzz?
There's a town here. Maybe we could get through that way.
You didn't follow the old Route 66, which went
no,
from,
we
according
we
to the great song lyric, goes from Chicago to L.A.
That's true. Guilty.
Look for a side road up ahead now, anywhere.
What river's it on?
Pascagoula?
The joy of watching these old episodes of Route 66 is not only seeing who the guest stars are, but seeing who the actors are, who weren't big enough stars yet to even be credited as guests.
Right.
You worked with everyone.
Yep, that's true.
Robert Duvall appeared in a couple of them.
Martin Sheen. Jimmy Caan.
Right.
James Caan.
And at the beginning of one episode, you see a young man in a suit. I might add a young man with dark brown hair running after a woman through the woods. It's Robert Redford.
Correct. Inga Stevens. Suzanne Plachette. Tuesday Weld. All of these people were unknown at that point.
You also wrangled with a crazed young Leslie Nielsen.
Correct. Where he thinks the end of the world is coming.
Dr. Crisper, do you really believe it?
I'm here, aren't I?
I mean, if you really think there's something to all this, why don't you warn people?
Because I'm told that in these times, there are certain things that are better left unsaid.
Leslie Nielsen was still very serious.
Yeah, not only that, but he was wrong.
You also had on the program an ornery Lee Marvin.
Right.
One of the two of you clear out of here. I was out late last night and up early this morning.
Why don't we try something first? Why don't we put you in there?
You remember that?
Oh, yeah, I remember. I went over and pushed him off the fence. That's right. Lee Marvin did two shows.
Uh-huh. You remember all these plots?
Oh, sure. They were good shows. I enjoyed them.
Your character, Buzz Murdoch, he's supposed to be street smart. He's
right.
You're a tough guy. You're a fighter.
Right.
How's your lip? I've been hit harder by dames.
That's the pilot. That was Everett Sloan. He hits me in the mouth, and Marty asked me, how's my lip? I said, I've been hit harder by dames.
That was 3 seconds. I could play anything from 3 years, 3.5 years of this program, And you could call him right out what that was.
Let's see.
We'll challenge you.
Look, you want any help from me? You're going to have to crawl to me, X1.
That's with Robert Duvall. Mm-hmm. And it's called Birdcage on My Foot. He's a drug addict.
You can't do it, Packy.
Can't do what, job man?
I hear it's a 5-hand hit for tonight.
That's the one with Martin Sheen and James Caan.
But you do remember all of your lines from...
Yeah, well, pretty much.
It's not bad. This was a time, 1960, 1961, 62, when the motor trip across the country, the drive around America, was a big deal. People were doing this at that time.
I can't tell you how many people wrote to me and told me that that's what they wanted to do after seeing the show. And, you know, they wanted to buy a car and toot around.
When you and Martin Milner would look at the shooting schedule for a season, would you say, oh, wow, great. At least by week 5, we make it to Philadelphia.
We never saw the schedule. It was week to week.
You didn't know where you were going?
No, we didn't know where we were going, and many times we didn't know what the script was until 2 days before shooting.
But I assume that for a run of a couple of months, you would stay in one part of the country. I mean,
well, we would try to do 3 or 4 shows in the same area, but that didn't mean we had 3 or 4 scripts. And I remember we were in Cleveland doing the one with Nehemiah Persoff about the Russian hill, and we were standing on the bridge, and we had no pages. We didn't know where to go yet. But luckily, they had to raise and lower the bridge, and in the meantime, the plane landed in Cleveland, and a car took the script and brought it to us because we didn't know what clothes we were supposed to be in.
It's a good thing you guys could pack all those clothes in the trunk of that Corvette, yeah.
Yeah, it was terrific. I enjoyed it. It really demanded that you make it work.
Well, Georgia Maharis, it's just been great fun talking with you and hearing all about the making of this terrific old TV show, Route 66.
Yeah, I'm a terrific old guy.
You are. You are, if I may say so, too.
Thanks a lot.
Actor George Maharis, he's 83. He and Martin Milner starred in Route 66, a TV drama from the early 60s. The complete series comes out on DVD this week.
Now, it's not quite as dramatic as Battleship, but here's another movie story that could easily be distilled into a short movie trailer. The life of 15-year-old Jake Fushi, and this is what it would sound like if it were a trailer.
In a world where a voice can separate the boys from the men.
I about say 14 again.
Jake was actually 14 when his story began, but now...
You mean to start over?
He's 15. Sure.
One 15-year-old is walking the line and charting his own destiny. In theaters everywhere, Friday.
A little explanation here. When Jake was 13 and his voice changed, he realized his was just a little deeper than his friends.
Hello, my name is Jake. I am 14 years old.
So he decided he might want to use his voice for a career someday. So a few months ago, he posted a video on YouTube, just Jake, in front of his computer with a microphone.
I'm trying to become a voice actor, and this is my movie trailer guy impression.
In a world where the Earth was no longer in our control, with our survival at stake, we have one chance, and that chance is to fight back.
So naturally, the video goes viral. He's 14.
In theaters everywhere, Friday.
And the next thing Jake knows...
I remember that the first day I got an email from Good Morning America.
14-year-old Jake Fushi from North Carolina has become an internet sensation.
And I was insanely surprised by it, and I did not believe it. And I told my dad about it, and they didn't believe it either.
What do you want to do?
I'd like to be a voice actor when I'm older, like for movie previews or just movie trailers and stuff.
He told us Good Morning America was fun.
Welcome back to Good Morning America with Robin Roberts and George Stephanopoulou.
But his next stop was the Ellen DeGeneres Show.
Well, Jake, it's quite a voice you have. I'm excited that you're here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, so when did your voice start to get
And she sprung a surprise on you.
Yes, she did.
Right?
Yes, ma'am.
So we called the Abrams Artist Agency in New York City. It's one of the most highly regarded voiceover talent and literary agencies in the industry, and they would like to officially sign you. You have an agent.
And I was really excited about that and insanely surprised. And I couldn't even believe it.
Have you had any, have you signed a deal yet?
We haven't gotten into everything yet, but we are working with them now. My mom and my dad are all having conferences with them and getting everything worked out. So hopefully we'll get a lot of the big stuff going this summer.
Who else do you do?
I can do Optimus Prime from Transformers.
How does he sound?
Before time began.
There was.
The cube.
The cube. We know not where it comes
wow.
from.
That's crazy.
Thank you.
What about at school? Like, are you like the most popular kid now?
Well, a lot of people have come up to me and congratulated me, and so a lot of people are trying to be my friend now, and it's fun, but also I'm just trying to remember who my real friends are and keep everything in check.
What about dates? Any luck there?
Well, I have a girlfriend, actually, since before all this started, and still with her now. She's really happy for me, and she's with me through it all.
That's Jake Fushi. His original viral video is at our website, npr.org. Coming up, music from a new band that describes its sound as orchestral folk. That's in the next part. Excuse me. That's in the next part. Forget it. Jake, can you finish this one?
That's in the next part of All Things Considered from NPR News.